Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Pete Musto, and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
The containers of tulip flowers in storage at Henk Vandersloot's farm in the Netherlands were supposed to go to Vatican City. The Roman Catholic Church planned to use them to help celebrate the Easter holiday on April 12th. But travel and transport restrictions forced a change of plans. The church will go without the famed Dutch flowers this year. The church is not alone in that. The coronavirus is a disaster for the Dutch flower industry, said Michel van Ski. He is the press officer at Royal Flora Holland, a group of growers that sells some 12 billion plants and flowers each year. But van Ski said 85% of the market turnover has disappeared. That is a big problem for the industry. Last year, Dutch flower exports brought in more than 6 billion euros. The Dutch government says the country has a 44% share of world trade in flowers and plants. Some Dutch farmers are now giving away tulips to healthcare workers as a way to thank them for helping fight COVID-19. It is not only growers in the Netherlands who are hurting. The pain has spread to farmers in Europe and Africa. In Kenya, few people are at work at Maridadi Flowers, a farm about 90 kilometers north of Nairobi. Normally, 120 people are busy at work in the company's product quality control area. But it is almost empty now. The few employees there are cutting down roses and throwing them away, about 230,000 to 250,000 flowers each day. Owner Jack Neppers is a Dutchman who has worked in Kenya for many years. He said about 80% of his 720 employees are at home. This is costing us about $500,000 a month, Neppers said. He said he will start to dismiss employees if the situation continues much longer. At Royal Flora Holland's large auction, few flowers are being traded. The auction was the point of sale for about 4.7 billion euros worth of flowers last year. Now it is asking farmers to send only about 25% of their usual crops. Frans Vandersloot is keeping his tulips in cold storage for as long as possible. He is hoping sales will recover around Easter on April 12th. But if he is wrong, he will have to throw out his flowers. Earlier this week, he threw out a lot of tulip bulbs because it would not be economical to plant them. They fed them to cows, he said. They were first-class bulbs. I'm John Russell.
The people of Guadalupe, Arizona, are very proud of their history. The town's name comes from Our Lady of Guadalupe. It is linked to the reported sightings of Mary, the mother of Jesus Christ, in Mexico during the 1500s. Yaqui Indian refugees from Mexico established Guadalupe in the southwestern United States over 100 years ago. Today, the town is known for religious ceremonies connected to the Christian holiday of Easter. But people there are a little worried about outsiders as they prepare for the 2020 census. The U.S. Bureau of the Census plans to gather information about the country's population and their communities next month. Town leaders hope to ease any unwillingness to join the population count, which takes place once every 10 years. That is because the census could decide if Guadalupe gets more federal money. The local government has a budget of $12 million. The town uses the money to repair roads and the local wastewater treatment system. Every revenue stream is important to a community as small as this one, town manager Jeff Kulaga told the Associated Press, or AP. Across the country, small poor towns, such as Guadalupe, present problems for census workers. These communities are often home to one or more ethnic groups. Language barriers and poverty can be a problem. It can be very difficult to count people who move from place to place to find employment. Such individuals can be distrustful of the government. The U.S. government has already delayed sending workers to count college students during the coronavirus pandemic. As people are asked to keep their distance from one another, counts in places like Guadalupe could grow even more difficult. Native Americans make up almost one-third of the 6,500 people living in Guadalupe. About 70% of all people there identify as Hispanic. A third struggle with poverty in the community, where the average yearly household income is around $32,000, and the average owner-occupied home is worth less than $90,000. Just 60% of adults finished high school. It is a similar story in Immokalee, Florida. A recent wave of immigration by indigenous Guatemalans who speak Mayan languages has created challenges for the local government. The nearest hospital is nearly 50 kilometers away in the wealthy community of Naples. Immokalee is a farming town and home to 25,000 people. It has been called a food desert, meaning it has few food stores. More than 43% of the population is in poverty. A similar percentage have not finished the first year of high school. An AP study shows that such small, poor, and largely Latino communities historically have been undercounted in earlier censuses. Devera Cohn writes about the census for the Pew Research Center. She said it is an increasingly difficult and costly job to count these hard-to-count groups. It may be because they distrust the government or are moving around or people who don't speak English, said Cohn. The Census Bureau is spending $500 million in advertising, $50 million for ads designed to ease the fears among some Latinos. This includes trying to ease their concerns that they will be asked about citizenship, which is incorrect. I'm Pete Musto.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Several governments around the world have requested or ordered their citizens to quarantine themselves, to stay at home, to avoid contact with others. Quarantines help slow the spread of diseases like COVID-19. Quarantines, however, can cause health problems themselves. People are at greater risk of anxiety and depression as a result of the isolation caused by quarantines. So health experts around the world are offering advice to help deal with the undesirable effects of quarantines on mental health. Psychologist Claudia W. Allen is among them. She directs the Behavioral Science Department at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. She leads the Family Stress Clinic there as well. Allen says continuing with normal routines as much as possible will help you stay healthy during quarantines. For example, she says people should continue to wake up and get dressed at their usual time. She says with some people staying in pajamas all day could lead to feelings of being unproductive or without purpose. She also advises people to make plans. Write a list of activities and times for carrying them out. These activities might include cleaning your home, paying bills, making calls, and preparing meals. Health experts also suggest eating your meals at your usual times. Allen says everyone should include self-care activities during quarantine, such as exercise, reading, or playing musical instruments. Getting exercise is important. Even if you must stay indoors, make sure to move your body. Maybe seek some online exercise classes. Keeping a list will help you balance the things you have to do and the things you want to do. Allen also suggests using a quarantine to develop a new skill or to learn about something. Like most health experts, Allen also advises people to make sure to spend time outdoors. Being in nature can help to ease boredom and other tensions of quarantine. So, take a walk. Work in the yard if you have one. Start a garden. Explore some woods or wild areas. Get sunshine on your face. Wash your car or bicycle. Allen says helping others is another way to lift your spirit during quarantine. This could be as simple as calling someone who is alone or greeting a neighbor from your window. You could also provide a service online. For example, if you are a teacher, you could offer online homework help to friends who must now homeschool their children. And keep a check on your own feelings. If you are experiencing difficulty from the effects of quarantine, contact a healthcare provider, a community organization, or an emergency hotline number. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Britain was once the most powerful nation in the world. It ruled a far-reaching empire. We look at how British power gave way to American influence after World War II. One can almost name the day when this happened. It was February 21st, 1947. British diplomats in Washington called the State Department. They had two messages from their government. The first was about Greece. The situation there was critical. Greece had been occupied by Germany during the war. Now it was split by a bitter civil war. On one side of the fighting was the Greek royal family, supported by Britain. On the other side were communist-led rebels, supported by Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union. British forces had helped keep Greece from becoming communist at the end of World War II. A few years later, Britain could no longer help. It needed all its strength to rebuild after the war. So on that February day in 1947, Britain told the United States it would soon end all support for Greece. Britain's second message that day was about Turkey. Turkey was stronger than Greece, but the concern was that it too could become communist unless it received outside help. Britain warned the United States that the Soviet Union would soon extend its control all the way across Eastern Europe to the Eastern Mediterranean. It called on President Harry Truman to provide strong American support to help Greece and Turkey resist the communist threat. Britain, in effect, was asking the United States to take over leadership of the Western world. The United States was ready to accept this new responsibility. For months, relations between the United States and the Soviet Union had been growing worse and worse. The two countries had fought together as allies in the Second World War. But Soviet actions after the war shocked the American people. The Soviet Union wanted to block Western political and economic influence in Central and Eastern Europe. It wanted to extend its own influence instead. So after the war, it forced a number of countries to establish communist governments.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent.
Britain's Prime Minister Winston Churchill described the situation in a speech in March of 1946 at Westminster College in the American state of Missouri.
Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. And all our subjects, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and in some cases increasing measure of control from Moscow.
Churchill warned that the Soviet Union was trying to expand its power. He described it as an iron curtain falling across the middle of Europe. This iron curtain divided Europe into a communist East and a democratic West. The situation was made even more tense by news coming from China. China was a divided nation at the end of World War II. The forces of nationalist leader Chiang Kai-shek controlled the southwestern part of the country. Communist forces under Mao Zedong controlled the north. Both the United States and the Soviet Union expected that Chiang Kai-shek would be able to unite China. Chiang and the Nationalists won several early victories over the Communists, but Mao and his forces used a growing hatred of the Nationalist government to win support. Slowly, they began to win battles and capture arms. Early in 1949, Communist forces took control of Peking, now Beijing, and Tianjin. They captured Shanghai and Canton. By the end of the year, Chiang and his nationalist forces had to flee to the island of Taiwan. The fall of the nationalist government on the mainland caused a bitter political debate in America. Some critics of the Truman administration thought the United States had not done enough to help the Nationalists. The Truman administration rejected the charges. It said Chiang caused his own defeat by failing to reform and win the support of the Chinese people. Secretary of State Dean Acheson described the defeat this way: "The unfortunate but inescapable fact is that the ominous result of the civil war in China was beyond the control of the government of the United States. Nothing that this country did or could have done within the reasonable limits of its capabilities could have changed that result. Nothing that was left undone by this country has contributed to it. It was the product of internal Chinese forces, forces which this country tried to influence but could not. A decision was arrived at within China, if only a decision by default." The United States was more successful in its policies toward Europe. The British warnings about the communist threat in Greece and Turkey led President Truman to speak to Congress. He said, "I believe that it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures." Truman called on Congress to give him $400 million in aid for Greece and Turkey. After a brief but intense national debate, Congress agreed. Truman then launched an effort to save the Greek economy and reorganize the Greek army. Soon after that, Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union ended their aid to Greek rebels. The civil war in Greece ended. American help for Greece and Turkey was the first step in what became known as the Truman Doctrine. The goal of this policy was to stop Soviet aggression anywhere in the world. Truman was willing to use military force to stop the spread of communism. but he also believed it was equally important to build up Western European nations so they would be strong enough to defend themselves. Europe was suffering terribly after World War II. There were severe shortages of food and fuel. Crops were destroyed. Many Europeans were beginning to look to the communists, to anybody, to save them. This is one reason why Truman and his advisors developed a plan to rebuild the economies of Europe. After the war, President Truman made George Marshall his Secretary of State. Marshall had led American troops as a general in World War II. Now, as the nation's top diplomat, he proposed the idea for rebuilding Europe. This idea became known as the Marshall Plan. President Truman explained why there had to be a Marshall Plan. People were starving, he said. There had been food riots in France and Italy. There was not enough fuel. People were cold and sick. Tuberculosis was breaking out. As Truman said later, something had to be done. Secretary of State Marshall described the plan during a congressional hearing in Washington.
Why must the United States carry so great a load in helping Europe? The answer is simple. The United States is the only country in the world today which has the economic power and productivity to furnish the needed assistance. The 6 8/10 billion proposed for the first 15 months is less than a single month's charge of the war. To be quite clear, this unprecedented endeavor of the new world to help the old is neither sure nor easy. It is a calculated risk. It is a difficult program. And you know far better than I do the political difficulties involved in this program. But there's no doubt whatever in my mind that if we decide to do this thing, we can do it successfully. And there's also no doubt in my mind that the whole world hangs in the balance as to what it is to be.
The United States offered aid through the Marshall Plan to all countries in Europe. The Soviet Union and its allies refused help. 16 other countries, however, welcomed the aid. From 1948 to 1952, administrators of the Marshall Plan worked with these countries. The United States spent $13 billion. The plan worked. Agricultural production in Marshall Plan countries increased by 10%. Industrial production increased by 35%. Production in some industries, such as steel, increased by much more. There were political results as well. Stronger economies helped prevent communists from gaining control of the governments in France and Italy. Some Europeans criticized the Marshall Plan. They said it increased tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union in the years after the war. Yet few could deny that the plan was one of the most successful international economic programs in history.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.